This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The thing I'm offering to voters that's different is I'm telling them I'm going to go there to fight for these larger structural changes. And that's going to mean fighting not just the Republicans, but sometimes fighting the Democratic Party establishment as well. And I think there's this moment in 2026 and 2028 where politically anything might happen. You know, I really believe there could be this huge change cycle going into 2028. And we have to be able to shape that to be a change cycle for these large solutions that'll actually fix these big problems that people have been facing.
In November, former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi announced that she's retiring from Congress after serving nearly 40 years. Now, San Francisco voters and, well, the rest of the country are wondering who can fill her 4-inch pumps. This week on Sea Change Radio, the first half of an in-depth, sit-down conversation with Shoykat Chakrabarty, who's running for the 11th Congressional District of the U.S. House of Representatives. We look at Chakrabarty's unusual career path into politics, from software engineer to co-founder of the progressive political incubator Justice Democrats, to serving as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff and co-authoring the Green New Deal, Chakrabarty may be one of the most qualified individuals to ever run for a freshman seat in the House. We learn about his environmental policy ideas, how he balances local and national concerns in a congressional campaign, and the success he's had in inspiring a younger generation as volunteers, staffers, and voters. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Shoykat Chakrabarty. He is running for Congress in California's 11th District. Shoykat, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Alex.
So why don't you first tell us a little bit of your backstory and how you decided to dive into politics and run for Nancy Pelosi's old seat?
Sure. So I grew up in Texas, actually. I didn't grow up here in San Francisco. Pretty much middle class, you know, went to public schools and moved out to SF back in 2009 when I was 23. I've always wanted to live out here pretty much for as long as I can remember. And, you know, to me, SF, it always represented sort of the best of America in a lot of ways. It's like the city where we're innovating, we're building the future, but we're also this real melting pot where anybody can come from anywhere and we accept you. And I think that's a really incredible thing. But when I came out here, you know, initially I worked in the tech industry, and I was part of that era in 2007, 2008, where I really thought I'd be, you know, solving all the big problems in the world through tech. It was around the time Muhammad Yunus was like doing microfinance loans to lift the world up from poverty. But living in San Francisco and working in tech and seeing the effects of kind of the crazy inequality and the cost of living crisis all around me, I realized that's maybe not what I was actually working on, right? So I quit. And it's like really cheesy to say this today, but I literally wrote a list of what I wanted to do. I was like, you know, I want to work on inequality, poverty, and climate change. And at the time, I wasn't political at all. I was maybe looking at some nonprofit work to do, but Bernie Sanders started running for president. And he was talking about those three things in a really compelling way and attracting thousands of people at these huge rallies all over the country. So I thought, well, I want to see what that's all about. So I went and joined the Bernie campaign in 2016. I ended up working as his director of organizing technology, which is a fancy way of saying I was building tools for the organizing team that's trying to organize that massive million person grassroots army that was all around the country. And that was really empowering. You know, that was really what radicalized me politically. I caught the bug because I saw how I could use these skills towards something that actually felt potentially impactful. But long story short, you know, of course we didn't win that race, but a group of us from that campaign, we jumped off and we thought, you know, could we do that sort of Bernie movement, but for Congress? And we actually started a group called Brand New Congress at the time. And the idea for Brand New Congress initially was to recruit 400 people, run it at like a big presidential, like 400 person presidential race, you know, take over Congress, do the Bernie agenda, and a lot of the stuff that eventually became the Green New Deal. We didn't manage to quite get there. It was a huge failure. We didn't recruit 400 people, but we did recruit about 15 people that first cycle. Eventually, the project turned into Justice Democrats. And we had, one of the people we recruited was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I ended up running her campaign in 2018. And after she won, I went to DC as her first chief of staff. And I was put in charge of writing and launching the Green New Deal. And I've basically been working on that and some version of that for the last, I'd say, 7 years now, because the idea with the Green New Deal was really to, you know, massively up the ambition on climate and also talk about climate as not just this crisis, but a way to create millions and millions of high wage jobs. And since, you know, I worked with AOC in DC for about a year, I left, came back to SF. And for the last 5 years, we've been working at New Consensus on a very comprehensive detailed plan called A Mission for America, which is basically like a sequel to a Green New Deal with all the details filled in. But that's sort of what I've done in politics. You know, I think you kind of asked me like how I ended up, running for Congress actually myself. So I've been working kind of behind the scenes, running campaigns, recruiting candidates, working on a lot of the policy details for about a decade now. And after Trump won this second time in 2024, and the Democrats campaigned saying that, you know, if Trump wins, we might lose our democracy. I think that's real. You know, I take that seriously. And then I saw the Democrats' actual response to Trump being in office, and I don't think they're taking it seriously at all. You know, I really don't think they're using every tool that they possibly can to stop what I believe is an authoritarian coup right now. But more than that, I don't think Democrats are really interested in the question of how do we build a clean economy that creates prosperity for everybody. Like, I don't think they believe it's possible, right? And I do, you know, and I believe it's possible to do not just from a policy standpoint, but also politically. And that's largely what drove me to put my own name in the ring and decide to run for Congress, to try to take some of these ideas, take them to Congress, and build a team of people who can actually get it done.
And this team of people you speak of are very young, I've noticed. That's not coincidental, I'm sure. And it's very encouraging. I was discouraged to see that in 2024, the turnout in 18 to 24 year olds was 44%. That's come down significantly since 1964. And we knew going into 2024's election that the key we just keep hearing every cycle is the youth vote. You know, you see the videos of lines in at campuses, and we're like, all right, the kids are finally getting it. But they didn't this 2024 election. Speak to the enthusiasm you're getting from younger people and specifically your staff. I mean, it seems like everybody's under 40, and you're under 40.
I'm under 40, but only for a few more days, actually. But you know, I'd say the other thing in the 2024 election, that not only was voter turnout from younger people lower, but there was a big shift actually among younger people from generally voting for Democrats to towards Trump. And I think it all boils down to what is the vision of a future that we're offering young people? Because all the problems that we see in society today, you know, whether we're talking about the cost of living crisis, whether we're talking about climate change, these big problems are facing young people the hardest. Like, young people today coming out of high school, coming out of college, they're looking at a future where they're never going to be able to afford a home. They're probably not going to be able to afford to raise a family. They're seeing AI as this, you know, existential threat to the job market. They're seeing this rapidly warming climate that the adults in the room are completely ill-equipped to handle or do anything about. And there's this nihilism that sets in where when they hear sort of the normal political response to it and sort of these small iterative changes that a lot of Democrats pitch, like, well, that's not going to do anything. And then you have someone like Trump come along, and Trump's not pitching any answers either, but he's just pitching change, right? He's pitching something, you know, that feels bold and dramatic. So I think that was a lot of the reason for the shift towards that. And, you know, on my campaign, we're talking about doing the big structural changes to these big problems. And that's the core of why young people are attracted to the campaign. And yeah, you mentioned a lot of people on the campaign team are young. We have a lot of volunteers who come out to help us out. We've had over 2,000 volunteers so far in the campaign, knocked on over 100,000 doors in the city. And it's tons and tons of people. Every single canvas I ask folks, you know, is this, how many of you is this your first time getting engaged in politics? It's usually about half the people who show up every single time. And it's because we're presenting something new and different that actually seems like it might solve these real problems. And of course, I'm very active on social media. I'm trying to get that message out in the venues where young people are paying attention. But social media alone isn't going to solve it. You actually have to have a message that connects.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Shoykat Chakrabarty. He is running for California's 11th District in San Francisco for the House of Representatives. So, Shoykat, you're not running for president. You're running for a congressional district. And going to one of your town halls, I noticed your tireless willingness to just answer every question that everybody has there. And that speaks to your dedication to this process. But I also was listening to a lot of the questions, and they were very, I wouldn't say provincial, but they weren't all big picture questions. It was like, what did you vote on Proposition K? And what do you think about the school board recall? And there was definitely some inside baseball kind of San Francisco issues. How do you find that balance between supporting your constituents and still trying to keep the big picture in mind with a democracy under threat?
You know, I think it's, I actually don't necessarily see it as a balance of two opposing forces. I think they're intimately connected, because ultimately the bigger things I'm talking about doing, you know, when I talk about universal healthcare or talk about doing something like the Green New Deal to solve climate change, I have to connect them back to how this will affect the lives of voters in the district. And so that goes both ways. You know, I have to be able to pitch these ideas in a way that people understand will affect their lives directly. And I have to be knowledgeable about all the issues in the district so I can both connect it and so I can do the part of the job that's representing folks in the district. It's, I'd say, like you mentioned, a lot of like kind of local issues, like things like my vote on Prop K and stuff like that. And ultimately, like in this campaign, you know, I'm not taking any corporate money or any lobbyist money. Like the confidence I'm going to get to go out on a national stage and advocate for these big sort of risky positions in a lot of ways, I'm talking about new ideas, right? I get that confidence from being able to know that I'm going to be solid in the district and I'm actually representing the views of my constituents, and I'm solid on the knowledge of what they want to hear and who they want to be representing them. And I really model this a lot from how I saw AOC act as a representative when she was in Congress, because she's this big national figure. You know, she takes these big political risks nationally. She's always out there. And but she's extremely present in her district. Like, she advertises her constituent services constantly. She does town halls. When I was there, she was doing them like every other month. I don't know how often she does them now. And I saw how her ability to know she's connected to her actual constituents, that gave her the confidence to go out there and take these big positions nationally. And then also it kept her grounded, right? Like, sometimes when we talk about things like climate change or these bigger ideas, there is a tendency to get sort of abstract in our own minds. And I think having to explain these to people on the ground in San Francisco in a campaign, that helps ground the issues in a way that actually connects to people.
I can see it from a politician's standpoint, where you're caring for your constituents, gathering ammunition for bigger issues, narratives that you can carve into bills and speeches on the House floor that are filled with anecdotes of people who are being affected by this economy or by whatever policies are being discussed. But I guess from an observer standpoint, a non-politician, I can't help but constantly feel that push and pull from voters who either take a bigger picture and are watching cable television and are often in the, will we be able to impeach Trump? Or they're not even thinking about more granular issues. It's more almost a horse race and what's the polling, or is Trump demented, or whatever it might be, versus the voter who looks at it like, what can you do for me?
Yeah. When you talk about those two different things, right, they're like the voter who's looking at sort of these national issues, what are we going to do at a legislative way, or in a legislative sense, you know, nationally, versus what can I do for voters directly? I think you have to have an answer to both, basically. Like, I think there are things I can do individually as a congressperson, and I talk about that in the town hall. You know, I talk about what I can do through my constituent services office. I talk about how I can fight for money back in the district. But I do always try to make the point that if that's all I do as a congressperson, I will have failed, right? Like, I don't think that's enough. I think we're at a point where we have to do these big structural changes to our systems to fix the root causes of problems like the crazy cost of housing, of healthcare, of childcare, of all the things that are driving the cost of living crisis in San Francisco. If we really want to solve these problems, like just trying to bring money back to a district, that's just like a Band-Aid on the problem every single time. And, you know, I'd expect anybody representing San Francisco to do the damnedest they can to fight for the city to bring money back to the district. The thing I'm offering to voters that's different is I'm telling them I'm going to go there to fight for these larger structural changes. And that's going to mean fighting not just the Republicans, but sometimes fighting the Democratic Party establishment as well. And the other thing I talk about is the how we get there. You know, if we actually want to do something like pass single payer healthcare or pass something like a Green New Deal, it's not just going to be me. I have to work with other congresspeople around the country. And that's part of what I'm trying to do in the campaign. I'm trying to recruit people. I'm trying to talk to folks who are challenging the Republican Democratic establishment, you know, people who aren't taking any corporate or lobbyist money, and build those relationships now, going with a real plan to work together. And I think there's this moment in 2026 and 2028 where politically anything might happen. You know, I really believe there could be this huge change cycle going into 2028. And we have to be able to shape that to be a change cycle for these large solutions that'll actually fix these big problems that people have been facing. Because if we don't do that, then, you know, going back to a voter who cares about Trump, we might not get Trump again, but we're going to keep getting authoritarians in power. We have to solve these larger economic problems. And so that's how I try to connect it. Like that's what you're really voting for. If you vote for me, is for me to go be that change agent. But of course, I'm also going to have to represent San Francisco and do everything I can to, you know, I guess, do the short-term fixes to the problems that exist right now. I mean, when you see something like Medicaid getting defunded, yeah, we got to get money back to try to just stem the bleeding, but it can't just be about stemming the bleeding. We have to get to the larger solutions as well.
Let's talk about that short-term versus long-term structural issue. In San Francisco, the lightning rod issue is housing. Your Democratic opponents, Scott Wiener and Connie Chan, have a different perspective than you, I think, on it. From what I've read, Wiener wants to keep building market rate housing, which I think will bring more wealthy people into San Francisco and won't necessarily allow blue collar workers to afford to own homes in San Francisco. Connie Chan does not agree with Wiener's approach at all. She doesn't believe in, I wouldn't say NIMBYism, but she's not really pushing for more affordable housing. You look at this as an income inequality issue, but what's the short-term solution while we can keep the long-term perspective in mind? It's not an easy fix, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental issue with housing right now is the cost of housing is skyrocketing. And in the short term, when I talk to developers of affordable and market rate housing, what I hear is there's no money available to fund any kind of housing without rents going up a ton, right? I think that's the root cause of the problem. And neither of my opponents, I'd say, have real plans for what to do about that. And the proposal I have is to recreate something called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which we had in the New Deal World War II era. It's kind of like a big public bank that could directly finance and build affordable housing and market rate housing. But at the same time, I think we need to have federal government support to keep people from being displaced. So that's another short-term thing. Like, we need to expand rental vouchers. We need to actually have support for things like tenants unions that allow folks to stay in the homes that they're in right now. Because I think that's kind of the short-term like crisis is, as these costs are going up, people are just getting kicked out of the city. You know, hundreds of thousands of people are getting kicked out of the city over the course of the last decade, I think, is what's happened.
I mean, we saw during COVID how if we had to, we could allow people to not be evicted, for example. Like, yeah. Those were short-term Band-Aids, obviously, but they allowed people to not lose their homes.
Yeah, and you know, and the problem that often happens is when you have the sort of approach to housing that someone like Scott Wiener has, where his belief, I think, is if we just cleaned up all the red tape, made it really easy and fast to construct, that the private developers would solve the problem for us. And, you know, and I'm not against, like, make it easier to construct. I just don't believe that second part, where we can just rely on private developers. I think that's delusional. You know, I think we're not going to get affordable housing that way.
Yeah, if you're getting into San Francisco housing, you're not looking to build affordable housing for people who are not high net worth individuals. If you get into the San Francisco market in particular, it's because you think that you can take something that would be worth $500,000 in Bakersfield and sell it for $3 million in San Francisco, right?
Exactly. And so you need to have government financing and government developers to actually build the affordable version of it. But what I was going to say is, you know, that's why a lot of folks in I'd say the Scott Wiener camp, they tend to be against things like rent control or against displacement protections, because they see those as impediments to the private developers building the housing. And I say that we need rent control because we don't want rent to go up higher. And if the private developers can't build it at can't build market rate housing with that level of rent, then we need public developers to build it instead, right? Like the answer can't just be rents keep going up at a crazy rate. We have to actually keep the cost controlled.
And you know, when I was in school, we used to sing it something like this. Listen here. Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain, far purple mountain majesties. Above the fruited plain. But now wait a minute, I'm talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. Yes, he did. Heavy brotherhood from sea to shining sea. You know, I wish I had somebody to help me sing this.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Shoykat Chakrabarty. He's running for California's 11th district. Let's talk about the Green New Deal that you helped craft. It became a boogeyman from the right, where they would talk about it in these very, I don't think most of them read it, but anything that had to do with stopping big oil, anything that would impinge on anybody's lifestyle in any way became a huge talking point. But if you could go back, how would you prioritize rolling it out in terms of what's most pragmatic and realistic and palatable to Americans at this important juncture in our environmental policies?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing about the Green New Deal is, it wasn't actually pitching all that much about anybody having to change their lifestyles. That was kind of the opposite of what the Green New Deal was trying to say. Like, we were really pitching this other approach to climate change. There are two big things we're trying to pitch. One, we were saying that the Democrats at the time that they needed to up their ambition on climate quite a bit. And the other big thing we were saying is we actually need to mobilize our economy the way we did during the World War II mobilization, where, you know, we used our economy to build war material. But instead of war material, we have to do that to build all the clean industries and technologies and clean manufacturing that to replace all the old dirty fossil fuel stuff. And that fundamental thing, that's still the thing we have to do. You know, it's. I guess, you know, if I can count that as one thing, that's the thing we still have to do, right? And what we're trying to present,
That's why it was the New Deal. This was like the Tennessee Valley Authority, but for solar power.
Exactly, exactly. And what we're trying to reintroduce really into the American political conversation was how you do that. Like, if you look at the history of when we did it during the New Deal, but also during the World War II mobilization, if you look at the history of pretty much every developed nation today, that all of them, you know, if you look at them during the 20th century, at some point, they went through these massive upgrades of their economies, and they did them really fast, often in one generation or two generations. And I'm talking about, you know, post-war Europe, all the Asian countries during the 70s and 80s, the Nordic countries during the 90s. If you look at how they did it, you know, they really operated in this completely different mode of operating. And those were the ideas we're trying to pitch with the Green New Deal. And I'd say the Green New Deal is best thought of as not a piece of legislation we're trying to pass, but it was a political strategy that we're trying to use to introduce these ideas into the political economy at the time. And in that, it succeeded. You know, that success came from a combination of kind of capitalizing on media moments and some political courage. Because the way we introduced the Green New Deal, if you remember, you know, AOC, she did a sit-in in Nancy Pelosi's office on her first day in D.C., which took a lot of guts, right? And she joined Sunrise Movement to do it. And then through a combination of inside-outside organizing where, you know, I was on the inside working the presidential campaign staffers, working all the members of Congress, Sunrise was on the outside putting pressure. They were showing up at these town halls, asking everybody running for president to respond to a Green New Deal. And that kind of pressure actually resulted in everybody running for president responding to a Green New Deal with their own climate plans that are quite ambitious. And that talked about climate as a way to build up industries to create high wage jobs and reverse decades of economic devastation, including Joe Biden. He responded with Build Back Better, and that became the Inflation Reduction Act and actually passed and created the largest investment in climate in history. Now, you know, when I go back and think about that time, you're right that we were sort of isolated in trying to defend the Green New Deal, right? And that's why it would allow both the right to attack it and allow the members of the Democratic Party establishment to attack it. If I had to redo it,
I wasn't saying you redo it as much as if you could prioritize it on day one, but you could go back and see how people reacted to it, though, I guess. And now with that in mind, how would you prioritize your wish list?
Got it. You know, I'd say, like, you know, I think if we're serious about tackling climate change, we are talking about a transformation of a large part of our economy. So in terms of how I prioritize it, it's really about prioritizing the pieces of it that enable that transformation. So for me, it would be pushing the ideas of creating public financing and public coordination institutions that can enable that kind of transformation. So I talked about the Reconstruction Finance Corporation earlier. That's something that we have a proposal for at New Consensus for creating a modern day version of that. That would probably be the first thing I'd want to pitch and push and try to really build a consensus around, because that could enable the kinds of investment and the kind of coordination we need to build out all these other clean industries and clean technologies that we have to get to.
Tune in next week on Sea Change Radio for the second half of our discussion with congressional candidate Shoikat Chakrabarty.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jack McDuff, Little Feet, and Ray Charles.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.